Mind and Body Reset, Modern Wellness Decoded. Science-backed wellness made simple.
When was the last time you were in a city park, or even just walking down the street, and you stopped to really look at an insect? Not to, you know, swat it away or step around it, but to actually just watch it.
That's a great question. And I think for most people, the answer is probably a very, very long time. If ever.
Exactly. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Welcome, everyone. This topic is, well, it's personal for me. I grew up in a place where summer nights were just thick with fireflies. It was pure magic. And I realized a few years ago, living in the city, that my own kids have, well, they've never seen one. Not once. And that absence, that quiet little void, it really started to bother me. It felt like a symptom of something much bigger.
It is. For me, the hook was discovering the science behind it. I was reading about the concept of forest bathing, Shinrin-yoku, and I went down this rabbit hole. I found studies linking our mental health, even our immune systems, to the biodiversity around us. Not just the big, obvious nature, the trees and the birds, but the tiny, crawling, flying, buzzing life, the insects. The idea that the health of our urban ecosystem, right down to the beetle on the sidewalk, is directly connected to our own wellness.
It's this invisible web that holds everything together, and we've been systematically, if unintentionally, pulling it apart. That's the heart of our conversation today. The power of forest bathing, the impact of urbanization on insect biodiversity and wellness.
We're going to explore this intricate connection between the concrete jungles we build and the tiny creatures that are struggling to survive within them. We'll be joined by some brilliant minds, entomologists, wellness experts, to really unpack it. We're not just talking about a decline in bugs. We're talking about a decline in the very fabric of the ecosystem that supports us.
And we're going to ask a crucial question. As our cities grow, what are we losing in the quiet disappearance of these creatures? And more importantly, how can we start to rebuild that connection, not just for their sake, but for ours? By the end of this, I promise you'll never look at a patch of weeds on a street corner the same way again.
It's so true. That patch of weeds, we're conditioned to see it as an eyesore, right? Something to be paved over, tidied up, sprayed. We see it as a void, but it's the exact opposite. It's a tiny, bustling metropolis.
A metropolis, exactly. Or maybe an airport, a crucial transit hub. You pave over that one little patch, and you think you've just made things look neater. But what you've actually done is you've severed a lifeline. You've just demolished the only bridge for miles. That's habitat fragmentation in miniature.
Right. It's not just that one square foot of land. It's about the connection between that square foot and the next one, and the tree down the block, and the park a mile away. So when that connection is broken, what happens? The creatures that needed it just vanish.
Well, some do. The specialists do. The ones that need a very specific plant, a particular type of soil. They're the first to go. And what you're left with are the generalists, the species that can live anywhere, eat anything.
The pigeons, the rats, the house sparrows.
The ones that thrive in the uniformity we create. So you don't just lose numbers, you lose variety. Every city starts to look the same, not just in its architecture, but in its biology. It's a process called species homogenization. The unique ecological signature of a place gets erased.
Wow. So that feeling you had about your kids never seeing a firefly, that's not just nostalgia. That's you noticing homogenization in real time. You're noticing the erasure of your local ecological dialect.
That's a perfect way to put it. And this process, this simplification, it's not just happening on dry land. We see an even more dramatic version of it happening in the water that flows through our cities. There's this term researchers use, urban stream syndrome.
Urban stream syndrome. Okay, that sounds vaguely unpleasant. What does that mean for, you know, the actual stream?
It means the stream gets a fever. Think about all the stormwater runoff, everything on our streets. Oil, heavy metals from brakes, fertilizers from lawns, pesticides. It doesn't just disappear. It gets funneled directly into the nearest waterway.
So the water becomes a chemical cocktail.
A toxic one. And it's not just the chemistry that changes. The flow changes. Instead of a slow, steady absorption into the ground, you get these violent, erosive floods every time it rains, because the water is just shooting off the pavement. The stream banks get torn apart, the temperature spikes, and only the toughest, most tolerant species can survive.
So you end up with the aquatic equivalent of pigeons and rats.
Essentially, you lose the sensitive mayflies, the caddisflies, the very insects that are the foundation of that entire food web. And we know this is happening with certainty because of these incredible long-term research sites, LTERs they're called, places like the one in Baltimore or Phoenix. They've been collecting data for decades, measuring these changes drop by drop, year by year. It's not a guess. It's a diagnosis.
A diagnosis. And it feels like the patient is the entire city. Because that water, that syndrome, it doesn't just stay in the stream. It seeps into everything. It becomes part of the system that we, in turn, rely on.
Exactly. And when you're dealing with a patient that complex, you have to look for the points of resilience, the hidden strengths. And this is where the story gets really, I think, hopeful and frankly, a little weird. Researchers are finding these last stand pockets of biodiversity in the most unconventional landscapes imaginable.
Unconventional how? Like, not just parks?
Not just parks. Think about the places we barely notice. I was reading this incredible study from Australia about their urban restricted threatened species.
I don't know. Abandoned lots? Maybe some overgrown railway lines?
Some, yes, but also roadsides, military land, school grounds, and get this, golf courses and airports.
Airports? Seriously? The land of jet fuel and endless tarmac? How is anything surviving there?
It sounds completely counterintuitive, right? But one specific endangered flower, the guinea flower, persists almost entirely on the grounds of an airport. Another, the spiked rice flower, its main holdout is a golf course.
A golf course. I'm trying to picture it. Between the perfectly manicured greens and the sand traps, where is the nature?
It's in the in-between spaces, the rough, the areas around water hazards that aren't heavily managed. These places are often large, fenced off, and have surprisingly low human foot traffic in those specific zones. They become accidental sanctuaries. The goal is to find a way to manage them for that purpose without compromising their main function.
So it's not about turning the airport back into a prairie. It's about being conscious of the prairie that's still clinging on at the edges of the runway.
Precisely. And that consciousness is the key. Because having these species so close to large human populations is, well, it's a double-edged sword. It's a huge risk, but it's also a massive opportunity for engagement. If the community is aware, if they're involved, they become guardians.
Okay, so that's about protecting the last remnants, the survivors. But what about all the things we've already lost? Is it possible to bring them back? To actually reintroduce a species into a city?
That is the next frontier, and it is incredibly delicate work. You can't just, you know, show up with a crate of something and set it loose. There's a whole framework of guidelines to avoid, well, to avoid making things worse.
I can imagine. I'm guessing rule number one is something like no reintroducing wolves to city parks.
That is, verbatim, the first type of rule. No predators capable of killing children. It's a non-starter. But it's also no species that significantly threaten human health, or pets, or even property.
So, no hyperallergenic plants or, I don't know, termites.
Right. And it goes deeper. You don't reintroduce organisms that carry pathogens. You don't introduce genes that could damage the existing gene pool of what's already there. And most importantly, you only do it when there is a reasonable chance of long-term survival. It can't be a death sentence.
So it's not a symbolic gesture. It has to be a real, scientifically backed attempt at rebuilding. And what about the people? The ones who live there?
That's the final and maybe most critical piece. The people in the affected areas have to participate in the decision. It requires education and buy-in to make it sustainable.
So it's not just an ecological project. It's a social one. You're not just reintroducing a butterfly. You're reintroducing a relationship between that community and its own environment.
A relationship. That's really it, isn't it? We've spent this whole time talking about the science, about homogenization and urban stream syndrome and genetic guidelines. But it all comes down to that, rebuilding a relationship. And you can't do that from the top down. You can't just issue a memo that says, everyone must now care about mayflies.
No, it has to be built, person by person, block by block. And I have to admit, hearing all of this, it's a lot. It feels immense. The scale of the problem. It's easy to feel a bit helpless, you know? Like, what can my little patch of lawn or my balcony garden really do against all of this?
But that's the beautiful paradox of it. Your little patch is everything. It's the airport for the bee that needs to get to the park. It's the rest stop. It's the only diner on the highway for 100 miles. The scale of the problem is immense, but the scale of the solution is, it's hyperlocal.
So my final thought, I guess, is one of agency. Of realizing that the choice to plant native flowers instead of a perfect green lawn isn't just an aesthetic one. It's a profound ecological act. It's a vote for variety. For that local dialect you mentioned.
For me, I think my final takeaway is a bit broader. It's that we need to get more comfortable with the idea of our cities being a little messier, a little wilder at the edges. Those golf courses, those roadsides, they teach us that life thrives in the places we don't perfectly control. Maybe the goal isn't to manage nature within an inch of its life, but to consciously and deliberately make room for it.
To let that patch of weeds become a metropolis again.
Exactly, and to see the beauty in it, to see the life in it. Which brings us all the way back to the beginning, doesn't it?
It does. To just stopping and watching. I know that after this conversation, I'm going to be looking a lot closer.
I hope so, and I hope everyone listening does too. Forget the big picture for just a minute. Just find 1 square foot of green near you, a crack in the pavement, a planter box, anything, and just watch it for 5 minutes. See who shows up. I promise you, it won't be empty.
A perfect final thought. Thank you all for joining us on this journey. It's been a fascinating and, I think, a really important conversation.